my best anecdote about this is we got into like the Super Bowl pregame, like the pregame show leading up to the Super Bowl. We're like, what? We have our like crappy commercial that we made in my buddy's apartment showing on this.
Oh my God. And they still charge you, but just some reduced rate? Or how does that work?
We just paid our normal rate of like 80 cents a spot or something.
Welcome to the Product Market Fit Show, brought to you by Mistral, a seed stage firm based in Canada. I'm Pablo. I'm a founder turned VC. My goal is to help early stage founders like you find product market fit. Alex, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
I'm excited. I'm particularly excited for this episode because, you know, in this podcast, like we talk to mainly tech founders, and most of the times the sort of things that their startups are doing are kind of like esoteric, right? Like it's niche, it's a vertical nobody's heard of. And while the episodes are still like interesting because things, you know, still repeat across different verticals and so on, I find it's hard for people to understand what the company really does. In your case, like you were selling couches online. So I like, it can't get any simpler than that. I think everybody's going to get it. And you bootstrapped it to about $6 million in revenue. You exited and then you kept growing to like $40 million pushing furniture. And that is like, I mean, I think it's going to be an incredible story. So I'm excited to jump in. I guess for my first question, you know, if you could just set some context, I think you started about 2010, like what did the landscape look like back then when it came to online for online kind of selling and especially e-commerce for furniture?
Great question. The landscape for online furniture sales at that time was like, you ever see Mad Max? It's just like, I picture like law, like desert plains where you, there's literally nothing. No, it was, I mean, it was a very interesting time because there was really no big ticket items being sold online at that time. As crazy as that sounds, because 2010 feels like it was just yesterday in some ways. Like there were no independent furniture brands really to speak of. There were a few that were popping up here and there, and I'll tell you in a second, sort of our first foray into understanding that this was something that could be big. But at the time, IKEA, for instance, the biggest furniture retailer in the world, they weren't even transacting business online. Like there was no online payment gateway. It was just like a store finder, essentially, an online catalog. So that sort of frames the conversation. Back a few years before that, there were some early players and in the online furniture space. Now, furniture was super hot in like 2005, 6, and 7. This is when the housing market was going insane. Obviously, in 2008 and 9, it was terrible because the furniture market generally follows the housing market. My best buddy at the time was a sales rep. He was pushing like big Bubba recliners, the type of couches that you know exist, and they sell extremely well in this country, but like you don't really see them that often in modern homes, but there's a lot of business going on. So it's an old traditional Mississippi manufacturer that sold these reclining couches. And his territory as a sales rep was coastal California, where we live, Southern California, mid-coast, like between LA and San Francisco. So he's going into these stores and I worked with him and we're selling like containers of these, you know, of these huge Bubba recliners to these stores. So all of a sudden he gets an email out of nowhere from someone who wants to open up an online account. So he calls a sales manager in Mississippi, and I'm not going to do the accent, but you could picture what this guy might sound like. And he's basically like, no, we don't have any online accounts right now. My friend is like, hey, can I open them up? Can I bring them onto the, he's like, yeah, let's see what happens. What do they need? Oh, they just need a spreadsheet of all the information and images and they'll do the rest. Okay. So he supplied them with this. And the next day he wakes up to like an order, like immediately. 2 days later, there was like 5 orders. 10 days later, there was like 20 orders every single day going to different parts of the country one at a time. This is a company that was used to selling like, you know, 100 at a time in a shipping container coming over from Asia. Now they're selling from their domestic inventory, one here, one there, one there. It grew so fast. My friend made a lot of money, and so much so that they took the account away from him and made it a house account because he was just like literally making too much money off of this.
Was this like drop shipping, just like in terms of how that worked at that point? Okay.
Yeah, it was like early drop shipping. This company had never even done that before. So they were going through the process of figuring out like, how do we even palletize single shipments to go to one place? Like that's something they had to adapt to as well. the retailer that was buying all this furniture was called CSN Stores at that time. And eventually they became Wayfair.
That's crazy.
And that's how we got into the furniture business, figuring out that like, oh, there's somebody who's doing this and doing a really good job. There's a ton of opportunity.
Was he supplying then one of the first pieces of furniture that, Wayfair would have sold?
Wayfair got at this early, like early 2000s. They started as CSN Stores. But even before that, just these two guys, they were not in the furniture business. Their story is really interesting. They have a great like How I Built This with Guy Raz, if anybody's interested. It's just a good business story. And they started with like just a very robust SEO-driven e-commerce strategy where they had barstools.com or like awesomemediastands.com. And like they bought up these URLs and then worked backwards and found the product to sort of fit those. Essentially use keyword research to back their way into the furniture industry to figure out like what were people interested in buying online. And then they sort of, you know, as I said, they work backwards from there. Very, very interesting story.
So your buddy kind of sees this, let's say, market pulse is this new model of selling furniture. Where are you in the picture? Like, are you all also working with him or like how do you enter?
I was an actor living in Hollywood. Like I used to sing and dance. I was singing on cruise ships when I wrote the business plan for Apartment 2B, our former company. But that's a whole other story. But I was always a very like entrepreneurial person. Like I didn't want to wait tables. So my friend was selling furniture. I was like, hey, let me sell some furniture with you. And my side job was like, we had this deal with Costco where we do all these special events and we basically like sell our couches at Costco next to the guy sampling hummus or whatever, you know? And I was like the sales manager for our Southern California operation. And I just did this on my off days. If I had like an audition, I would go do that. Or if I had a show, I'd take a couple weeks off. All that to say, I was doing that. He was doing this and we just started working more in that direction. And then he was at some point was like, hey, I have a good concept for making an online store where we're just like sort of bridging the gap between IKEA, which at the time was much seen as much more lower end quality, like, you know, as promotional as you can get, and Crate and Barrel, which at the time was seen as a little bit more high end. But there was nowhere where people in their like 20s who could go to buy furniture and feel confident knowing that they like got a good piece of furniture that's actually like good looking. That's where we started. And I was like, that seems like a pretty good idea. So I moved back to LA from New York at that time with my wife. And we started the business in his apartment. And hence Apartment 2B was born.
And so what was like the first iteration of the business? Like what were you selling? Where were you getting it from?
We basically ran Apartment 2B like a retail store. And my friend had run a retail store. I had worked with them too. So we understood sort of the basic ins and outs of running a mom and pop furniture store. We just did it online. So we didn't have this sort of grand scope or scale to the concept. It was just first, let's see if we can support ourselves with this lifestyle business of just selling furniture online and let's see where it goes. So initially, we just sort of got connected with a number of different suppliers. We used his prior connections in the industry to like literally just get people to sell to us because nobody in the furniture industry wanted to sell to online businesses. They saw it as a threat to their brick and mortar businesses, which still, by the way, 20 years later, drive the majority of the business in the furniture industry. So they're very protective of these players, but they, you know, a few people allowed us to like put their products online for sale. We put together a catalog. We spent a number of months building a website, and we basically just flipped the switch and did all these sort of alternative methods of advertising and marketing that were like we advertised on TV before. This was before Google Ads was even really a thing.
Where'd you get the money to do TV ads?
There was a lot of hustle here. Like he knew the TV guy for, and some wasn't Spectrum, but what was it? Time Warner at the time. He was like, hey, Dennis. We have this new business. Like, what can we do? Like, how can we get this going? And he's like, well, he's like, I know this guy. You can do like a little commercial and, you know, we'll put you in. We'll just choose like one demographic, like West Hollywood. And like it in that place, it's actually kind of affordable to like have a few ads. Let's see how they perform. But the key was the hustle was in that. He's like, hey, I got something good for you though. There's something called autofill where there's a time slot that wasn't filled yet. We'll slot your commercial in. So like my best anecdote about this is we got into like the Super Bowl pregame, like the pregame show leading up to the Super Bowl. We're like, what? We have our like crappy commercial that we made in my buddy's apartment showing on this.
Oh my God. And they still charge you, but just some reduced rate? Or how does that work?
We just paid our normal rate of like, you know, 80 cents a spot or something. I don't remember what it was, but we didn't spend a lot of money on marketing. You know, this was, I'm not saying it was successful. It's just more of a good story of how we like found these weird ways of growing that were not the conventional like advertising ROI focused route.
By the way, what did you use to build, like, this is, I mean, we're talking 2010s. This is when, like, you know, Toby from Shopify was selling snowboards online, right? Like, how did you, what did you use to build that website?
Yeah. Well, we ended up being a major, like, early adopter of Shopify. And that was a huge part of us being able to grow our business with all the players that emerged around that ecosystem. But prior to that, we first started on a Magento website, and we had like a local LA, you know, house build it for us, probably spend, I don't know, 30 or 40 grand just getting it going. We had some bells and whistles to it that we really like were proud of. We had this like package builder application where you could bundle products together, and it was like a living room package and choose your sofa. We give you four couches and you can choose which one you want. And then you go to the rugs. And this is something you see on websites every day, but back in 2011, this is not a big thing. So we got a lot of attention for that.
Do you remember your first sale?
Yeah, I do. I remember when we went live, we like pressed the button and went live, and then we didn't get a sale for like a day or two. And then our first sale, I think it was a friend of a friend, like someone we knew. So it wasn't like a random at first. That would have been unbelievable. But yeah, like somebody bought a bed, and then we're like, okay, this is us. Oh, wait. Oh, we have to get the bed now to give to the person. Okay. Who's doing that? It wasn't that ragtag, but
what did you, do drop shipping, or were you actually in charge of like the logistics?
Yeah. So drop shipping in the furniture industry at that time was very different than it is now. Right now, all the manufacturers, definitely all the major ones, are set up for drop shipping situation. Their packaging is ready to be drop shipped. They're used to shipping companies, like 20 different shipping companies coming to their distribution facility to pick up. Used to be that like they would be in charge. They would have one, you know, if you need us to ship to you, we're going to use, you know, R&L carriers, and we'll charge you the freight to give you your whole furniture order to your warehouse to sell in your store. For us, though, we had to sort of wait and massage things. So some retailers were able to ship direct, but most of them, we needed to have them send to our warehouse. And so we had to have a warehouse. And we had one here in the San Fernando Valley in LA, basically just like a roll up, and the stuff would come in and we would deliver it locally. So we started, we had like a zip code gate, and first it was Los Angeles only. And we did that for about 2 or 3 years,
working in LA. Did you have to hold inventory, or were you able to at least kind of time that properly?
We were able to time it properly so that we were always stayed cash positive. So we would take 100% customer deposit at the time of order placement, and, you know, someone would buy a dining table for $1,000. We would then buy it from the manufacturer for $500 plus, you know, whatever the shipping charge was to get it to our warehouse, and then we had to pay for delivery. There was some decent margin in this, but it was took a lot of operational hustle for every single order at that time for years.
And even just like, I'm just thinking, I mean, within between the website, between the warehouse, like how much money did you and your co-founder have to put into this just to get it started?
I think it was $125,000 total. We did like just my friend and his dad were the initial $50,000. And then we raised from another friend of my partner's another $75,000. And that's it. I say raise. I mean, basically it was like, is he lending it to us? We brought him into the deal, and luckily, he made out ahead. I mean, he got a nice return on his investment. But yeah, that was it. It was just basically a friends and family like cobbling together what we could. Luckily, we were always a cash positive business. So we were able, we never needed money. And after, you know, a couple of years in business, we were able to pay ourselves too. So it was like, okay, let's just, we were in a stable position. We can grow from there.
So, you know, I mean, the hardest part I would say of like any business is getting customers. So you get this first kind of sale, it's a friend of a friend, you know, I'm curious if you just think back to those days as you grew to that first million or so in revenue, like what were some of the things, and I'm curious to hear the anecdotes from back then, because I always find they're interesting. There's always crazy things you got to do to just kind of make it happen. Like, how did you get that first million or so in revenue? What were some of the experiments that you tried to really get customers? You know, what worked, what didn't?
Yeah, there were two things that were really instrumental in us, you know, really becoming, really getting a healthy revenue flow going. I hesitate to say healthy, because some of it wasn't healthy. The first thing we did was, at that point, Groupon could not have been hotter. There was Groupon, Living Social, and all of these like little deal sites. Everyone was like looking at them every day. Everyone was getting Groupon's emails at that time, because it was like, it was a new thing that everyone was sort of socially participating in. The good thing was nobody was doing them for furniture. So we saw an opportunity there. It was an easy pitch to them, like, hey, let's do a Groupon for furniture where somebody spends $100, but they get a $250 coupon or promo, a gift card rather, to our stuff. Now we knew that they were going to spend $750 to $1,000. So really we're just giving a, you know, 15 to 25% discount. Obviously, we got burned on this in various ways, but we also were able to use their platform.
Like what?
Just the margins of...
Well, I was going to say, I mean, what were your margins back then on a couch?
Well, we were working on what they call a keystone, which is 100% markup, which is a traditional furniture retail markup. That's what we knew. And at that time, we were operating as a local entity in Los Angeles. So we were able to really use sort of traditional, you know, financial modeling of a furniture store. The unit economics are, let's say someone was, you know, bought a $1,000 couch. They did the Groupon. By the way, we didn't even get the $100. Like, we got 30 of those dollars. So we are almost giving them, you know, let's say in this case, a 22% discount. We could probably support that. However, some people were like doubling up the Groupons. Some people were just buying like $500 items where we would actually lose money. And at that time, we were so bullish about it and probably irresponsible that we were just, we'll figure it out later. Let's just get as many customers as possible. And I don't know that that was the wrong strategy. Like, we really did make a name for ourselves within this world. And just, I don't know, just word of mouth started spreading. We provided a great product and service, because we actually were good at that from the jump. Like, people were satisfied with it. We were getting really good reviews on Yelp and things like that. So we were able to sort of leverage Groupon, basically, instead of paying for advertising, it's sort of like a, this, you know, affiliate marketing partnership, so to speak. So that's one thing we did. The other thing was working with Costco. So I had mentioned before, my friend had run this whole operation with Southern California. Costco was a very successful partnership with all Costco's in SoCal. So we got back in touch with the buyers and we're like, hey, we have this new business. They gave us a chance. And it was super successful. So we like did a test event or two where we would go into Costco for 10 days. We'd put like 6 couches on the floor. We would let people decide which, you know, we'd give them like a choice of 10 fabrics that were approved by Costco. And people would be coming in for their diapers and their, you know, pierogies, and we're selling them couches on the spot. Or they would come back, you know, one additional visit, and they'd come back after measuring their house and they would buy it. But we would do, you know, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 in a week at Costco, and they take 14%. Wow. There's no other participation fee. They just want a cut. So for us, there was a very little risk involved. We would just go there. We had to have, you know, this like small inventory of stuff. But for a few thousand bucks, we were just in another cash positive situation where they just wanted a cut of whatever we sold. And as long as we sold enough, they'd keep us going.
Costco wasn't selling the couches. I mean, they're just giving you space and traffic. And that's the normal model for them, for those, because, you know, you walk through Costco, you see these things, selling barbecue, selling this, selling that. So that's the model.
Yeah, that's generally a model. I mean, we did it up until a few years ago, probably 5 or 6 years ago. We did it for 8 years with Apartment 2B.
Wow.
And we did online events with them that were incredibly successful as well on Costco.com. The local operation, it kept us going, man, and it got the word out. I think their model is still the same, if not exactly the same, similar, if not exactly the same. The other thing is they do dictate, they approve everything. You know, it's Costco. It's their way or the highway. So they approve the products, they approve the pricing, and they work you down on the pricing, like to a place where they know that the customers are going to buy. You know, we wanted to sell something for $1,000 and they're like, how about $800? And we're like, okay. So our margins were thin on a lot of that business, but we were running, you know, one or two events at any given time congruently. So it was a nice revenue stream for a growing business.
And walk me through the timeline. Like, I mean, that's one of the challenges of, there's upsides and downsides, obviously, to being bootstrapped. I think one of the challenges is you don't get a salary at the outset. And the second one is you don't have like dollars to kind of fuel things. So it often takes longer to get things going. Like, how long did it take to hit 100K, to hit $1 million, like to hit an amount of revenue where you could support the operation and even maybe grow it?
The big unlock for us of getting to a place where we really started to see it as a scalable thing was when we started shipping nationally. That was in 2013. Very few online furniture retailers were doing this at that point. It was the Wild West. And I think that's where we crossed like the $1 million a year threshold in 2014. Probably something like that after 3 years or so in business. Now, mind you, this is furniture. So these are big ticket items. It doesn't require as much volume. I mean, we weren't selling t-shirts. Those numbers aren't maybe as impressive. Like $1 million means a different thing to a furniture operation than it does to another one. But it was still, these are still big milestones. So like, yeah, the first year we did like nothing. And the second year with all of our crazy Groupon promotions and such, and with Costco, we were probably in, you know, 300K to 500K, then maybe third year, 750K. And then when we started shipping nationally, that's when we started to like grow exponentially a year to over a million.
Did you or your co-founder ever regret it? Like, I'm just trying to think about, you know, you're doing, let's say $500,000 or so. You said 750K, you know, half of that is cost. So there's maybe, you know, a few $100,000 of gross. And then you got whatever other expenses. And then you net it all out and you look at what's left in your pockets. And you're like, oh, I could have just sold couches for my old employer, I would have made more or whatever. Did you guys ever think that way?
100%. Because right before we started Apartment 2B, I had a little side hub of business. Like I had four roll-up warehouses at like an extra space storage facility. And I would just bring in containers of like one type of couch. And I would pop them on Craigslist and deliver them myself every weekend. Just me. So, and I made a lot of money. And then here I am, like waiting for the money to come in. My wife and I, we had some savings, like from our wedding and stuff. We just kept pulling into our savings for the first 2 years. So yeah, those thoughts creep in a lot. It's like, okay. But also what drives you, I think, is the opportunity. Like we had all these big opportunities in the beginning. Like a few years in, we were on Shark Tank and my partner like pitched for an hour to the sharks. Like we were this close to being huge so many times. So that those
did you
types
guys,
of,
so you pitched for an hour, but did you get on the final?
No, they were, okay. We didn't get on the show because there wasn't any real drama. They really liked it. Obviously it was not like a, you know, it was something they seriously considered. I'm very superstitious. It was the first pitch of the new season that they were doing, whatever season it was. They're like drinking their coffee. All right, everybody ready? All right, who's first? I mean, are they going to make a deal on the first one? I don't know.
No way.
I would say probably never. But yeah, my partner did amazing. We got him prepped and he pitched this idea. And it really wasn't much at the time. It was just like a lot of opportunity in online furniture. And we have like an angle. You know, we're already successful. This is something worth investing in. So they liked it, but ultimately did not make a deal. High percentage of these, of the pitches we never see. Because a lot of them are just like, you know, good businesses that they liked, but there's no drama or something, a hook.
And how steady was the business? Like, obviously you're selling, you know, one of the challenges of furniture is somebody buys a couch, they probably don't come back, frankly, for a few. I mean, maybe if they got a new place, they buy a few things all at once, but, you know, oftentimes they'll buy something and they won't come back for many years. Like, it's certainly not, you know, SaaS. There's no kind of recurring element to it. How did that translate, especially at the beginning? Like, at some point you get to scale and things kind of take care of themselves. You kind of understand what seasonality looks like, but what was that like the first few years? Did you have some quarters that just things seemed to come to a halt and you're just wondering if the whole operation makes any sense?
I don't remember in the very early days too well. But what I will say is our volume and revenue was very consistent. Very, very consistent. This was probably due to a few reasons. We just like stuck to a lot of formulas that worked for us. Like, we did a lot of experimentation, but when we found something that worked from an advertising perspective, and at some point, obviously, yes, we started really advertising, but things worked, you know, we kind of stuck to them and tried to find the formulaic approach.
what was repeatable, like from the advertising? Because Groupon didn't work. Costco obviously did, but it was kind of like you can only do so much of it. What was the thing that just was always running?
Well, Costco was a through line for us for a long time. So we can depend on that revenue. Early on, you know, we started advertising. Like I remember when we first doing Facebook ads when it was like they just got came out and doing a lot of things like that. Like when we found something that worked, we would work it really hard. Or when we were started doing Google advertising and saw something that was successful, we would just like stick to it and really try to establish the baseline. But the other thing about furniture is like we really were aware of when people are buying furniture. I wouldn't call it seasonality in the traditional sense, and that like people buy toys, you know, 90% of the toys that are bought or, you know, are bought in the month of December. It's nothing like that. It's very consistent. It's like the wave is like this throughout the year. The market is driven by holidays and major sales events. So you have like President's Day, Memorial Day, July 4th, Labor Day, Black Friday. These are like, those are the big five. And then you have all these like other ones like Martin Luther King weekend. It's just like the car and mattress business and furniture runs along the same cycles. So during those times, if we showed up with a good promotion and we put our advertising focus on those time periods, we are able to achieve consistency because there's something like almost every 6 to 8 weeks in the furniture space that we can sort of hang our hat on from a marketing perspective. That really contributed a lot to our, you know, consistency. There's just this promotion, like inherent promotional calendar that we followed in the furniture industry was very helpful.
Do you remember any specific promotions you ran that worked especially well, like to the point where you're like, whoa, like we just struck a nerve with that one?
Yeah, no, I just think we realized early on the power of being promotional. So that's not the answer to the question that you're looking for, but a lot of new brands are like, how promotional should we be? We have a premium brand here. Like, should we even be on promotion? And our thing was like, once we saw that promotions worked, we're like, no, no. And we learned that early on with Groupon. Like, we got all these people to buy furniture that weren't even interested in furniture. Same thing at Costco. They were coming in there for diapers. So it's really the promotion that gets people over the hump when buying furniture. And it's an incredibly competitive landscape. So we knew that that worked for us. I think our first like Black Friday sale where we, you know, gave 30% off and saw like just that number, the percent off, how much people are saving. That's what people are focused on in our industry. They want to know how much they're saving. So much more interested in that than how much they're actually spending. They just want to feel like they're getting a good deal. We basically realized there was a direct correlation between how much discount percentage we give and how much people buy. As simple as that sounds, it's not always that linear. So we then figured out a way to price our products in a way that we could give 15% off and 20% off. And we're sort of driven by the promotional discount percentage that would drive the business. And we worked backwards from there.
That makes a lot of sense. Maybe let's fast forward a little bit. You're growing this business. I mean, things are generally speaking going pretty well. At some point, you get acquired. Walk us through how that happened. Like, where did this acquire come from? And just how long did that process take?
The furniture industry, as I sort of alluded to a number of times, like, it's still catching up to the online wave. And that's a huge part of what I'm addressing right now with my new company, Couch.com. But we are in a position where these sort of old school generational players were like just becoming more comfortable with the online space, and also were saw it as an opportunity finally rather than a threat. And that's on the manufacturer and retailer side. Unsurprisingly, our suitor, the one that was interested in us, was a old school legacy furniture retail brick and mortar chain in the Midwest. They had about 30 stores, big stores. So I'll name a few names of retailers that are similar just to give, like in different places in the Southeast, like Rooms to Go is a good one. On the West Coast, Living Spaces, the Northeast, like Raymour and Flanagan, Bob's Discount Furniture, big, huge furniture stores, like built-in warehouse and huge showrooms. They're interested in moving into the online space. So they were looking for opportunities. We were always, after a few years, like fairly well known in the furniture space. It's a very big industry, but very incestuous, and everybody sort of knows each other. So, you know, we were one of the names that were getting thrown around, and a few online businesses like ours had been acquired over the past few years. So this was a model that other like legacy furniture retail brands were looking to repeat. We got approached, and I think for them, they were interested in bringing in our e-commerce expertise and experience to their world and, you know, seeing if we could sort of help catapult them into that space. And also just investing in a growing business that had a lot of opportunity that they could probably use their operational infrastructure to help support. Both things ended up being very true. And that's the reason we were able to grow the business so much post-acquisition.
You started around 2010. When did you get acquired? What year was that?
We started building the business in 2010. It went live in 2011, got acquired in 2018. So that's, that conversation started in 2017. So we were in business for about, you know, 5 or 6 years. I guess, I mean, it felt like an eternity, but theoretically, I mean, we grew pretty fast. My partner and I, we were making nice livings. Like everything was going really well. Our business was growing. We had a bunch of employees. And then this company sort of came to us and asked us if we'd be interested.
Walk me through the emotions, especially like the last few weeks before you actually get this deal closed. Because, you know, the reality of starting a business, and especially like, you know, I think a bootstrap business where, you know, at some point you're paying yourself a decent salary, but you're always, you know, you're always mining cash flow. And, you know, every now and then there's an entrepreneur who wants to build a business that they can run forever. But, you know, I'd say 99%, it's about building a business and at some point selling it and then doing another one. So when you get here, I mean, it's a huge event. What was that like? Like, what did that feel like, you know, those first weeks right before it, and then, you know, when the thing actually happened and closed?
I've never worked so hard in my whole life during the diligence process to provide all of the things that they were looking for in the format that they were looking for them. And we used a third party. I was doing big business things, you know, in my living room at night after my kids went to bed. And I was educating myself at the same time about how to do them and how to put together financial statements in the way that they needed to see them and things like that. So I'm super proud of the body of work that I did personally to just get us ready for that. At the same time, it was very rewarding because a lot of it was just asking and answering questions about like what made our business successful.
But what about like the anticipation of it? You know, were you able to just kind of coast and be like, well, if it happens, it happens. If not, you know, whatever, we have our business. Or were you like, oh my God, like, let's freaking close this thing. I can't wait to close this thing.
Option B, because we were at a certain point, I think with anything, you get excited, you start committing to it hardcore. And then we started really not counting our money or anything like that, but we were really focused on getting this done. And then we had like a snag right at the end in the last few weeks that delayed us about a month, which was interesting. It had to do with the difference in cash basis accounting and accrual basis accounting, that we were on cash basis and they were on accrual. And like it sort of materially affected how our payout and payment situation was going to work. And so we had to take a big one on the chin right before closing this deal. And I remember we were like, my partner who had a larger stake than I did, he was, you know, really thinking about shutting it down. So like, I'm hopeful, but also like trying to manage my emotions and also trying to keep him like calm and sane. And I'm like working all the angles at the same time. So when it finally closed, like, yeah, man, it's like, it's a, what a wonderful feeling, like to have a climactic moment in one's life. It's like winning a game. Like you watch these sports games, right? Someone wins a Super Bowl, like, man, what must that feel like? I'm not saying this is akin to winning a Super Bowl, but it is like,
well, the feeling is probably similar. Yeah.
You close something, it's done, and you can celebrate an actual achievement, not just growth or something more nebulous. It's like, you didn't sell the business yesterday, today you did, and this is the day you can celebrate. Does that make sense?
Boom. I love that. Yeah, makes perfect sense. Well, let's actually, maybe that's a pretty good endpoint, actually. Let me ask the two questions that we always close on. The first one is, I'm actually really curious how it fits in here. Like, when did you feel like you had true product market fit?
I think we knew early on that we had product market fit light, I would say, in the sense that we figured out that there was a gap in the marketplace that we were filling. Literally, like, price points and product that people were like, everybody who bought our stuff was like, oh, this is a really good value. So we found product market fit initially in our curation of the right product at the right price point. And then I think it was when we started shipping nationally and realized that people like outside of our word of mouth, like LA community, were actually interested in buying this product that we were offering product and a service, being an online, you know, business that would, you can buy furniture and we'll deliver it into your house and set it up for you and everything, so you don't have to lift a finger, that people were really looking for at the time. They were looking for this convenience. In 2013, when we flipped that switch and took off our little zip code checker, like, our first order was in Florida, I remember. And I'm like, oh, perfect. Literally the furthest place we could go to aside from Maine. But we figured it out. And that was a real unlock for us.
But, you know, there's something special about kind of getting out of your own backyard. I can tell you, I've heard that before from other founders. And even for me, like with this podcast, you see people listening, you know, from the UK or different places in, you know, like Spain, like different places in Europe. And you're like, it's crazy. It's just a similar feeling. It's one thing to sell in an area, even though you don't know the people you're selling to, obviously, but it's like, okay, it's kind of my area. And all of a sudden you're selling in Florida, you're selling in New York, you're selling in Boston, whatever it is. Yeah, it's definitely a 0-to-1 kind of experience. Let me ask the second question, which is, you know, now you're starting another company called Couch.com in a related space. The question is like, and really applies to you, like, if you could go back to when you were starting app to be with one piece of advice, or maybe now that you're starting Couch.com, what kind of piece of advice have you transferred over to this new venture?
Well, I have a pretty nuanced, like, specific answer there, but it's very, I don't know, it was very, very much an aha moment for me. Like, this past year, I've been immersing myself in the world of SEO and content marketing. And man, we were one of the early players in the online furniture space. I feel like if we really invested in that early on, and I think this applies on a more macro level too, like, investing in something about your business that isn't going to produce immediate cash, even if you have to like raise or do something uncomfortable to lay that foundation, I can see now like how much that would have paid dividends in actual dollars. So there's all these things about your business you're like, oh, I don't want to do this. It's going to be so annoying. I'd have to spend all this money and all this time. Let's just stay the course. Sometimes I think, and this is a good example of that, sometimes it pays to make that investment and do the thing that everyone tells you should do, but you're like, okay, because man, we should have invested in that. That company would have been, I don't know, 5 times the size of what it is right now, probably, just based on organic traffic alone.
That's perfect. Well, thanks a lot, Alex. Appreciate you having on the show. It's been an amazing, just an amazing journey, right? Like, frankly, simple idea, but just at the right time, executed the right way, and turned out to be a huge success. So thanks for sharing the story with us.
Thank you, Pablo. I appreciate it.
I just gave you content that you liked so much, you actually listened to the end. And guess what? You didn't pay a single dollar. Not only that, I didn't even put any ads in your face. So you just got a bunch of content for free. And now that I've delivered that value, I'm asking for something in return. Open your app, open Apple Podcasts, open Spotify, open whatever app you use to listen to this, and hit that follow button. It's actually going to help you, because it's going to help you make sure you don't miss out on the next episode, which you like so much that you listen to the whole thing.